Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ian and Peter Haig. And today we have a really interesting guest talking about a very big variety of subjects. First up,
that happens almost every week.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we sort of want to do that anyhow. But this first guest was such a delight, J.J. Johnson, who... He has a cuisine style, a culinary style that combines African, Asian, and American. And he developed this when he was working at the prominent restaurants in Harlem. The book is, we'll just let him tell you about it. The book is called Between Harlem and Heaven. I really like this guy. I'm getting too loud. I really like this guy. It's a J.J. Johnson, a chef, with such interesting experience, J.J. I mean, you've cooked all over the world, haven't you?
Yes, I have cooked all over the world. I don't know, all over the world, but I have cooked in these places that are the melting pots of the world that represent a culture... and the people that many people do not understand. So, I've been around the block, let's say.
Uh-huh. Well, I guess you have. Now, this book we're going to be talking about, you actually moved on from that, but we'll talk about that too. But this book is called Between Harlem and Heaven, a great title. And you wrote it with Alexander Smalls and Veronica Chambers. But it's about this combination Afro-Asian-American cuisine. Now, that's a big thing. That encompasses most of the world, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's most of the world. I think, but what we're really trying to show you is that the West African culture has impacted the world through forced migration. And everywhere forced migration went, they've impacted it through food. And that's the conversation that we're starting with. And then we're showing you how the Chinese and the Vietnamese and some of the Japanese have woven into the African culture around the world through travels and through chosen migration, in places like in ports of Brazil or in showing the Jamaican Chinese or showing the Trinidadian, Indian or showing, the Afro coast of Peru. So really, touching on places that many people haven't opened their eyes to yet when it comes to food culture.
Yeah, really, I mean, it's amazing. I mean, I basically had ideas of this rooted at the base of my skull, but I didn't put it all together into the big picture until this book. And I've learned so much from this book, J.J.
No, thank you.
But you started out in a fairly routine kind of place.
Yeah, I started out at, I think, a great place at the Culinary Institute of America as a young 17-year-old kid that was just a dishwasher and had dreams to run a restaurant one day. And I worked at some great places taking the traditional route. And then I happened to meet a great gentleman named Alexander Smalls, and we were off to Ghana and cooking in West Africa. So, and that's when I kind of realized who I am now cooking in Ghana and what I'm supposed to be cooking.
Yes. You're so lucky to have Harlem. We had a section in Pittsburgh called the Hill District, which was this great, you know about it, right? We had the Strayhorn Theater, actually.
No, I was going to say, I cooked at the Carnegie Museum maybe... 3 months ago.
Okay, that's part of that series, the dinner series, where they pair up the concepts of the show with the food.
Yep.
Yeah. I'm sorry I didn't get to that.
Yeah, why didn't you stop by? We're only about a mile away.
Yeah.
I wish I would have known. I would have definitely came out and hung out with you guys. You said you drink bourbon, so I would have drank some bourbon with you.
Yeah.
Yeah, we would have done that too.
Well, now, considering what you lay the groundwork for this and the picture comes through of all these different ingredients, but you put them all together with special touches, don't you?
Yeah, I think it's unique. You know, I'm actually really able to cook the food of really who I am. And what I mean is that my dad's African-American and my mom is West Indian and Puerto Rican. You know, we used to go to Barbados in the summer and visit family. And I truly hated the food. But now, you know, when I go back and I look at that or I travel, I truly see like the Caribbean, the West Indian influence, right?
Yeah.
And I'm able to speak to that in this book and in the things that I'm able to cook from it.
You're pretty good looking too, JJ.
No, thank you very much.
There are lots of big color photos. Well, I'm sorry, Brad. You're good looking too.
Get up there to Harlem if that's the way you feel. You better read about the mother sauce on page 56.
The West African peanut sauce, yes.
That's it, man. That's it. You put it on everything. It's like ketchup.
Yeah, you could use it on anything. Truly, you can. And just trying to show people that there is a mother sauce, right?
Yeah.
That could be part of it. This could be the sixth mother sauce, right? There's five, right?
Yeah.
This would be the sixth.
Yeah,
right?
This would be the sixth.
Or this would be the seventh. I don't know. I should know all the mother sauces.
Oh, we just interviewed somebody who wrote a really good book called something about the perfect sauce. And she goes through she's modernized the five basic things, which of course the mother sauces originated with the Escoffier and before that, I guess.
She said Escoffier got the ideas from some other guy.
Yeah, what's his name? You know who I mean. From CIA, you know. I just can't remember right now. But things that I have made over and over again, when I read your recipes, I think you've improved on them. Like the feijoada, I thought was fabulous.
Oh, thank you.
We haven't made it yet, but we're going to.
Yeah, I mean, that's just something that you could really do with each other or your family, right? Something that you can cook over a bunch of days.
Yeah, I used to make it for, we used to do a huge Christmas Day open house, and I would make that as the main centerpiece of the food, the buffet, and people loved it. But you've changed it. You've updated it.
Yeah, what did you put in your fresh water?
Oh, I'm trying to remember, but you have something in yours. I'm looking for this.
I put oxtail and lamb or gave.
Yeah, I didn't have.
I just put two meats in mine.
Right, it's the merguez is totally different. I didn't put any merguez in mine. What did I use? Some kind of pork sausage.
Probably pork sausage, correct? Yeah.
Could have been.
Yeah, and you like, and what did you use in that? What?
An oxtail meat.
And what?
Oxtail.
Oxtail.
See, and I didn't do the oxtail either, although I make a wicked oxtail soup.
That was the whole point of that dish, right? It was like saying, this was a true dish of migration. Normally you would put pork in it and have three different meats. And when I think of the food of, you know, the African diaspora, the number one meat that comes to my mind is oxtails. And where did that fit best in? And for me, that truly fit best in the feijoada. And then adding lamb merguez to it because, you know, you see merguez sausage in North African cuisine in Morocco, which is still on the West Coast. So that's why you see that sausage in that recipe. It's something that you could buy in the store. You can make yourself.
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm not going to make my own.
You can even buy it at Whole Foods, for heaven's sake.
Yep.
So I loved your comment on the collards. I laughed out loud at that one. I'm so tired of reading about the new kale. The poor collards.
No, right? We've all grown up on collard greens, right? You've probably grown up on collard greens or eat collards, and you make it the same way all the time.
Yeah.
And you're probably like, what can I do different with this? And you know, that's where the collard green salad came. It's like the ideal chopped salad.
I didn't grow up on collard greens.
No, you didn't. You were lucky you got food from your mother.
What did you grow up on?
He grew up in England.
No, we had a wonderful dish for three or four months out of the year called Spring Greens.
Yeah, that was great.
And spring greens is what you get when you let the Brussels sprout plants go wild after they've yielded their crop.
Oh wow, that's amazing! They should let that happen here.
They're a lot like collard greens, but you get an awful lot. You get an awful lot of spring greens for a pound.
Yeah. So now I make a lot of salsa verde because we get tomatillas in the garden.
Oh, beautiful!
I could try yours too with the. Your collards. You have some interesting observation about rice dishes, and of course, I bring this up for a reason because you're planning a new concept now. You're moving on, and you're going to have a rice concept instead of a noodle bar. You're having a rice bar. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, as I've traveled the world and been in Israel and Singapore and Ghana and India. Rice is at the center of the table. 85%, 90% of us grew up on rice. In my eyes, it's the most casual and common ingredient of them all, and it just has like a bad reputation. So, coming up with a rice bar instead of like a ramen noodle bar, and all the rice grains come from a specific place in the world, so it breaks down barriers, it invites all cultures in, and all the dishes are around the grain. And have some influence of the grain and where I've traveled.
Mm-hmm. And we were talking, what can you tell us about this new ancient variety of rice that was rediscovered?
Yeah. So, maybe about 6 years ago, I talked to Glenn Roberts about a grain called Guamarema, which is the, like, mother grain of all grains that comes out of West Africa. And a colleague of mine, BJ Dennis, has found that grain. And they're calling it Red Hills out of Trinidad. And it's a lost grain that hasn't been on the tabletop in a really long time. And I think to get it in the United States right now costs about $12 a pound.
So nice.
It's not economically affordable. So BJ is trying to find, a rice farmer here in the United States to grow the grain to bring it back on the tabletop. So it's something that's very exciting and should be really great to have back soon.
Now, is Glenn the guy who's so famous for Anson Mills?
Yeah, Glenn Roberts is the owner of Anson Mills, yes.
I thought so.
Yeah. Now, I mean, we've spent a lot of time in Charleston, and you've spent a lot of time in the whole of the Lowcountry, right?
Yes. Are you going to be in Charleston for Food and Wine Festival?
We used to go, but we haven't for a while.
It'll be my first year. I'll be down there.
We went when it was really new, and now it's so big, it's not the same.
It's a victim of its own success.
Yes.
But I'm sure you'll have a good time.
Oh yeah, we love all the chefs in Charleston. In fact, the best version of collard greens was what's the name of that guy who's
Wagner.
Bob Wagner, who I don't know, he's disappeared or something, but he had on the menu. What was his restaurant?
It was in the Charleston Hotel.
Yeah, but he had it with red wine and what else?
Oh wow,
it was good.
There's an island near to Charleston called Wad Walla, I think, or something like that, and it's so good for growing vegetables that. You get the name in front of it. So if you're a good collard greens, they're called Wad Walla Island collard greens.
Oh.
And then you cook them with red wine vinegar.
Well, I might have to try to check those out while I'm down there.
Right.
Yeah. So you have also a drinks section. Why is that?
Well, you got something to drink.
I think people are always trying to figure out, when they have a party at their home or get together, what should they make? What's this new drink that they can make to kind of have a show-off moment or be the drink of the day? So we're really showing you that you can take these flavors that are in the book and the savory food and really have it in a drink section, make some cocktails for your house in, like, large format and really be able to entertain your guests. If it was from the peanut punch to the blood and fire, and it just showing you that there's these savory ingredients that you can make into drinks.
Now, what's
there's a connection.
I'm reading this upside down.
Asian pear and plum kimchi, which sounds so totally exotic, can't believe it.
Now, the reason we're bringing that up is we happen to have an Asian pear tree in our garden.
Which produces 10 million Asian pears.
And we shared a sizable amount of the fruit from that with a bartender at a local restaurant, and he made a cocktail out of it.
And named it for us, on the menu.
Which is called an on the menu. But the tricky thing along the way and the value add was the fact that they smoked the Asian pears.
They have in a
Texas smoker before they made them into a cocktail.
That was so good. It's so balanced.
Yeah, we were at the restaurant again last night. I think they must have saved enough that we can always have one when we go.
All right, so when does this all happen, by the way? This new restaurant and so forth.
When will it happen? Yeah. Fingers crossed it should happen, hopefully, at the spring, beginning of summer.
Okay, and where will it be?
Harlem, of course.
maybe Harlem, maybe Chinatown, maybe NoHo or SoHo.
It'll be in New York.
I can't give you all the goodness yet. I got to keep some excitement out there.
when you know more details, you must let us know so we can broadcast.
Yeah, and we can do another 100%. Interview and promote it. It'd be great. So, 100%.
We'll do it again.
I think you're a fabulous resource, and I'm so glad we connected up. And, let us know when we can come to your restaurant.
Yeah, I will definitely let you know, and I really appreciate you having me today.
Yeah, well, good luck to you, JJ, and have fun.
I just have one final question. If the third J stands for Johnson, what do the other two stand for?
Okay, so this is a funny story. So my real name is Joseph Johnson.
Okay.
Okay. And when I would get in the kitchen as a young kid, there was always a Joseph or a Joe. So I was always called JJ.
Yeah.
And every time I would go to the kitchen, I was like, okay, I'm going to be the only Joseph, the only Joe. I'll be the only Joey. And I'd be, no, JJ. Because there's three Joey, a Joey, a Joe, and a Joseph. I used to tell my parents, I hate my name, I'm going to change my name. And when I went on Rocco's dinner party in 2009, one of the producers that was interviewing me was like, oh, my name's Joseph. So I think it's really weird if I call you Joseph, like, because it feels like I'll be, you know, we'll be calling each other and I might get confused. So can I change your name? So when they're calling your name, you know, do you have a nickname or something? Like, oh, man, you can just call me JJ. Everybody always just calls me JJ.
So JJ
went through on the film, and I don't know how it happened that my name on the screen was JJ Johnson, and that's been with me since 2009. So be careful what you wish for, and your name will automatically change some way, somehow. So, yes, I'm JJ.
Listeners, watch for the restaurant development coming out of JJ Johnson. Somewhere we think in New York, and meantime, be sure to get this book and cook up some of these fabulous recipes. The book is called Between Harlem and Heaven, Afro-Asian and American Cooking. Thanks for talking to us, JJ, and good luck.
Thank you very much. Have a beautiful day.
You too.
And if you think that's an unusual story, with a little bit of Africa in it, wait till you catch the next one right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. It seems that every day we encounter a new superfood. Yeah, it seems there's so many of them.
And not only that, a lot of them come from Africa.
Yeah.
Which is why we put this one next to JJ.
Anyhow, this one was discovered, actually. It grows all over the place, but it was discovered by Lisa Curtis.
By our guest, anyway. I mean, other people discovered it too, but she discovered it herself for the first time in the Peace Corps in what country? In Niger.
Right. And it's actually Cooley Cooley Foods is based on the superfood that's been consumed for hundreds, maybe thousands of years called moringa, and it's become very popular today. We're going to talk to Lisa about how she discovered it and what you can do with it. What you can do with it.
And Peter found a new use for it too.
Yeah, the Specialty Restaurant Association, which sponsors the fancy food shows, the winter one in San Francisco recently concluded, and they report on trends. And one of the trends that they previously predicted came true with the products at the show, including the latest superfood, which is Moringa. We're going to be talking to Lisa Curtis, who... Lisa, I'm going to ask you, you are the founder and CEO of a company that deals with Moringa in various forms called Coolie Coolie Foods. I was impressed with how you discovered this superfood, Moringa. Tell us about your Peace Corps experience.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me on the show. So I started working with this plant, Moringa, which is actually a tree. When I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Niger, West Africa. So I'm a vegetarian. I was living in a very rural village with no electricity and no running water and found myself feeling weak off a diet of beans, rice, and millet.
Oh, geez.
So I started eating Moringa for myself on the advice of some of the nurses that I was working with in the community health center. And then found that I was feeling a lot better, that I had a lot more energy. I was just, you know, it gave me the strength I needed. And so from there, you know, wanted to work with more women in my village to be able to help them grow more Moringa and eat it themselves. And one of their big requests for me was, you know, we're not going to grow a crop that we can't sell. So can you help us sell this crop?
Lisa, hold on just a second. Did the local people consume a lot of Moringa-related things?
Great question. So Moringa in Niger, where I was living, was largely considered to be a hunger food. So because it's one of the only crops that grows year-round, it was something that people ate if they had to, but they wouldn't eat it on a regular basis.
Well, you know, it actually doesn't taste very good.
It's funny, it does have
a pretty earthy flavor, but you can actually, you know, mix it with a lot of different things, and it blends in nicely with everything from pestos to peanut butter.
I tried some of the liquefied stuff with vodka the other day, and it tasted really good.
There you go.
I think liquid Moringa has a future as a cocktail ingredient.
You wouldn't be the first person to say that.
I'm sure I wouldn't be.
At Expo West, we're going to be doing Moringa margaritas.
There you go. Good.
Very popular cocktail that we make.
You're going to do that at Expo West, really?
Yeah, we will be.
Oh, that's funny. Now, I thought that the energy bars were quite good, but they had a lot of mix-ins like dates and that are just naturally good. I tried putting the powdered leaves or whatever. It says in our instructions that we could add it to almost anything. It did all right with my broccoli, but let me suggest that you avoid putting it on soft-boiled eggs. That didn't work so well.
That was a little too green. Yeah, it does. You know, Moringa works well with things that are already green when you're already expecting something to have kind of a green, earthy flavor. We found it does pretty good with that. It is pretty potent stuff. So if you imagine, like, if you were to take a bunch of kale leaves and grind them up into a powder, you know, it would be pretty strong. It's similar to that in Moringa.
I noticed in some of your advertising you have a Moringa versus kale contest.
Oh, yes, a lot of that.
Can you report
on the results of that?
So, you know, Moringa is incredibly nutrient dense. It actually has more protein, more vitamin A, more iron, and more calcium than kale. And so we've found that that's a really great way for people to understand what moringa is.
Now, are the trees very tall? I mean, are they big trees or are they little trees?
They actually get up to 20 feet tall.
Oh, okay.
So they can get quite tall.
So you might need to be able to climb trees in order to be able to trophy some moringa.
Yeah, so they generally, the farmers we work with will actually cut off the tops of the trees so that they can still be able to harvest them and not have to climb up on a ladder.
Okay. Right. So they're controlling the height of the tree just because that makes it easier for them to be able to get at the fruit. Oh, the leaves. It's just the leaves. It's just the leaves, right?
The leaves, yeah. So they prune the trees so that they can get the leaves within easy distance.
Okay.
Well, I can't imagine that it would be that easy bringing a product such as this to market. Tell us about how you did that and how long it took.
Yeah, so I started working with Moringa as a Peace Corps volunteer in 2010. I got back to the U.S. in 2011 and started this as really a passion side project for me. So didn't actually launch it onto the market until 2014.
Okay.
So we're, you know, a little over 4 years old, and have found that a lot of sweat and tears and blood have gone into it. But that it's definitely starting to really get a lot of awareness as an amazing superfood and as a really cool plant for everyone to be eating.
Now, what did you do? Were you in the food business before you got this product?
I wasn't, no. So I, after Peace Corps, I worked as the communications director at a clean tech startup. So I learned a lot about startups and how to, you know, start and grow a company. I then took that knowledge and applied it to the food industry, which was a newer space for me.
It's harder, though. I mean, food startups are really tough.
Yeah, food startups is definitely not easy.
They come and then they go fairly quickly.
Yeah,
you remember the wasabi from was it North Carolina or South Carolina?
It was American grown
wasabi, and they were at the fancy food show with the big booth, and the next year they weren't there.
Nobody'd
heard of them.
Now tell me this. I mean, all these supplements and superfoods are not regulated by the FDA. And so I immediately went on the internet to find out just questions about side effects, possible side effects to this. But lots and lots of stuff on there. But the only thing that that I could see was that if you're pregnant, you shouldn't take it.
Yeah, so that's actually something that applies to the roots and the bark of the moringa tree. The leaves are often eaten by pregnant women, certainly all over the developing world. Here in the U.S., you know, we tell people to ask their doctor. Don't give out medical advice, but I will say that, you know, we know that the leaves and the bark do have a certain amount of toxicity that has been used as like an abortifacient, for people to, you know, try to have abortions in certain parts of the world. But the leaves have never shown to have any of that toxicity in them.
Now, do you bring it in from Niger? Or is it somehow over there and then shipped in a different form?
Yeah, so we have the moringa washed, dried, and powdered in-country.
Okay.
So
right.
we're now working in a few different countries across West Africa and Central America. And then they ship the powdered moringa here to the U.S., and we sell it as a powder. We also add it to our protein powder smoothie mixes and our bars and our energy shots.
Okay, so it's partially processed, and then you have a factory. You're in Oakland, California, right?
We are. Yeah, we're in Oakland, California.
Now, the next important question, of course, is Okay, so it sounds like something you'd like to try. Where do you get some?
Yeah, so we are in 6,000 stores nationwide, including Whole Foods Market.
Oh, wow, there you go.
Safeway, yeah, quite a few places.
Are you on Amazon yet? I mean, everybody seems to want to be on Amazon.
We are on Amazon,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay, good deal, good deal.
Amazon.
Okay, so you can find it at least as many places as you can find kale.
I wouldn't go quite that far. Kale's probably got a little bit better distribution than we do, but can find it a lot of places.
But you could give it a slogan name like Kale Killer.
Kale Killer.
Kale Killer.
Yeah, that's
what does Cooley Cooley mean?
If you use that slogan, I'll expect a lifetime supply of
Moringa.
Moringa.
Yeah, deal. Kuli Kuli is a African word. It's in the Hausa. It's actually a popular snack that people make with peanuts. And in the village where I was living, they mix it with moringa. And so that's how I first tried moringa. And it goes back to our idea of like making moringa delicious and accessible to all, which is the mission of Kuli Kuli.
There's no downside to this. I mean, could you ingest too much of it? I mean, how much research has gone into it?
There's actually been a fair amount of research on moringa because it is eaten so widely all over the globe. I will say, you know, like any fiber-rich green, if you eat too much of it, it can have a cleansing effect.
Mm-hmm. That's a nice way of putting it, huh?
But there's not anything that we've seen or heard of other than, you know, I will say folks who are allergic to other brassica plants. So like broccoli, for example, if you're allergic to broccoli, moringa is related to broccoli. It's in the brassica family. So yeah, you probably don't want to eat it.
I see.
Okay.
Are you continually researching different delivery systems of this moringa? Right now you've got the bars, you've got the powder that can be sprinkled on things or made into smoothies, and then you have these tonic shots, which is the only one where I couldn't get that down. I mean,
that was the one that went so well with the vodka.
Oh, that's the one. So that's
yeah, so those are our wellness shots, and so the idea is that they're a mix of moringa and green tea, and they're, you know, kind of similar to a wheatgrass shot in that they are pretty green, but that you are getting a lot of great nutrients and vitamins out of them.
Right, and there are no dangerous side effects if you don't consume too much.
You know, we haven't seen any dangerous side effects.
Uh-huh.
Certainly, yeah, none that we've know of or have heard of.
Well, you must be pretty proud of yourself to start off like this and jump from the Peace Corps to a CEO of a growing company, huh?
Yeah, it's been a very fun ride, for sure.
Yeah, I don't know. You must be a very special person if you would take on one of these Peace Corps jobs where you're in a remote village with no amenities whatsoever. I mean, I never understood what motivated people to do that self-sacrifice.
Yeah, I mean, I think you learn a lot about the world and you learn a lot about yourself, and it's an amazing way to experience an entirely different form of life.
Well, Lisa, what a lovely story, and we're sure you'll go from strength to strength. I wouldn't be surprised to see a whole portfolio of products, moringa-like, in the future. So you must let us know if there's any more excitement that you'd like to share.
Yeah, I will let you know. Yeah, nothing we have to announce quite yet, but I'll keep you in mind.
Is that today's program with an interview on Peter's favorite subject, beverages, mostly of an alcoholic nature. Just in case you missed it, the moringa, what are they called? Those little bottles of Moringa, essence tonics. Of moringa. Tonics. Yeah. Tonics based on moringa mix very well with vodka. or with gin, even with a little bourbon. But what most people don't know is that it's possible to drink alcoholic beverages like wine at times of the year when you would least expect it, shall we say. And with the Passover coming up, we've tracked someone down who can explain to you why it's possible to enjoy really good wine that's properly appropriate for your religious festival. Kosher wines with J. Buxbaum of Royal Kedem, something or other. Ready for that one? You're looking at me strangely.
I don't know where you're going.
I'm not going anywhere. I'm just trying to introduce the final track.
The final track has to do with kosher wines.
All right. That's
mainly because that's simple. We're coming up to Passover.
Yes, so forget about all the rubbish Peter was saying before.
Future new product launches.
Thank you so much, Lisa, and much luck and prosperity to you and your company, Cooley Cooley.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Okay, it's time to close out today's program with an interview on Peter's favorite subject, beverages. Mostly of an alcoholic nature. Just in case you missed it, the moringa. What do they call those little bottles of moringa essence
tonics.
Of moringa tonics? Tonics based on moringa mix very well with vodka, or with gin, even with a little bourbon. But what most people don't know is that it's possible to drink alcoholic beverages like wine at times of the year when you would least expect it, shall we say. And with the Passover coming up, we've tracked someone down who can explain to you why it's possible to enjoy really good wine that's properly appropriate for your religious festival. Kosher wines with J. Buxbaum of Royal Kedem, something or other. Ready for that one? You're looking at me strangely.
I don't know where you're going.
I'm not going anywhere.
I'm just trying to introduce the final track. The final track has to do with kosher wines.
All right. That's
mainly because that's simple. We're coming up to Passover.
Yes, so forget about all the rubbish Peter was saying before.
We've talked, not since 3 years ago, to J. Buxbaum. I have a friend spelt the same way, calls it Buxbaum. I don't know, I guess that's a regional preference, right, Jay?
Yeah. Tomato, tomato, you know?
Yeah, I know. So, but anyhow, you are in charge of marketing and education for the Royal Wine Corp / Kedem. Kedem?
Kedem.
Kedem.
It's like the same word as Kedem, but Kedem, with a K Kedem. Instead of a G.
Okay, and but you were the largest distributors of kosher wine, right?
That is correct.
In the whole world.
That is correct.
And that used to be a really ugly word.
Yeah, many, many years ago.
Yeah.
Well, I was sent forth on the day of Seder in New York, where we were having Seder with one of Anne's friends, and I went to a wine store in Manhattan,
and they
had lots and lots of kosher wines, including cream white Concord. Spokesperson for them, you remember, was Sammy Davis Jr.
Absolutely.
So anyway, I was pretty sure that I didn't want standard kosher wine, and they had kosher sangria.
He's really bought.
So I bought kosher sangria.
With the traditional Seder meal.
It was absolutely awful.
Now things have changed.
A lot has happened and continues to happen.
Let's say why we're doing this is because, of course, we're looking forward to Passover, which starts on March 30th and runs through April 7th. And as I said, the first question I asked Jay, how much has changed since we talked to you last 3 years ago? And you said...
Oh, my gosh. OMG, as they say on text messaging, which my kids are fond of bringing me up to date on.
Yeah, it's good you have somebody to do that.
Yeah, exactly. I think, you know, the three areas that are of most note and that are most exciting for this particular Passover is, ascending order, is the continued evolution of California wines out of the Herzog Winery, the continued and amazing evolution and quality of Israeli wines out of Israel, but I think the most exciting and singular number of events for this Passover is the release of the 15 Grand Cru Bordeaux's.
That's amazing.
Are amazing, and some of which, many of which, have never been seen before, simply because, most Grand Crus, especially the 15, which is considered such a highly rated vintage, don't need to make, you know, they pre-sell pretty much all of their wines while it's still in barrel, en premier. And yet, we've gotten some of the greatest Grand Crus, I wouldn't say, not the first growths, but some of the greatest Grand Crus on this man's earth to make, smaller batches of this same wine that they make for everybody else under kosher supervision and therefore kosher for the kosher consumer.
Well, now this represents most likely, the motive for this would be obviously that it's a growing market because, they're not going to do this out of the goodness of their heart, right?
Absolutely. People ask me that all the time. You take a winery like Las Combes, which has just made a kosher cuvée, just released a kosher cuvée for the 15, and people would ask me, why do that? Why would Las Combes bother? Because it does mean that, they have to, not they have to, but they're, and in this case, fortunately, they're very happy to include a kosher rabbinic crew and integrate their kosher rabbinic crew into the production process. But why would they do that if they're selling every single bottle that they make anyway? And the answer to that is very simple. The same question could be asked of them when they started releasing and selling wines to Japan or to China. When you recognize that there is a market, a high-end market for your wines that really seeks it out and wants it and needs to be serviced, they go there to do that. And I think it brings prestige not only to, and services not only the market, that new market that they're serving, whether it be Japan or Hong Kong or China, but it also brings prestige to the winery itself. And that's what's happening in the kosher market, the kosher consumer, albeit, of course, the same thing with the non-kosher consumer, a small group, wants the best that wines can offer. And so they want the Las Combes. They want the Cantenac Brown for the first time again available. They want the new vintage of Giscourt in 15. They want the Léoville, which hasn't made a kosher cuvée in some many, many, many years, to come back and give them yet again another kosher cuvée. And these new wines, for the first time, are back. And in some cases are brand new. They want the Chateau Fontenil, which is a Lystrec, I believe, from the very famous, worldwide known Michel Roland's personal winery. And when you put those wineries together as a group, and you're able to offer them to the kosher consumer, it's just unimaginably fantastic for that group. They're really very excited about having those wines available to them.
Now, how did you get to be in such a prominent position, your company, in this particular area? I mean, it's certainly specialized, and it used to be Mogan David, and what was the other one?
Yeah,
that's a great question. Yeah. And I will tell you that the family that started this Royal Wine Corp here in the United States has been making wine since 1848.
I read that figure. Is that true?
Yeah, since 1848 in Czechoslovakia. And in fact, they were knighted, as if you will, as the suppliers to the Czechoslovakian court and the you know, I guess the prime minister. I forget, he wasn't called prime minister, he was called, oh gosh.
Dictator. No.
Well, they were the suppliers to the kingly court,
yeah.
And
yeah,
I'm sorry?
The Austro-Hungarian Empire.
The Austro-Hungarian Empire. And none of those wines were kosher, although they did make a small batch for themselves and for their families and for the local community. It wasn't necessary for it to be kosher for the Austro-Hungarian emperor. And so when they came to America, and they needed wine for the local market, as was the case with many immigrants to America. They came to the shores of New York, Ellis Island, et cetera, et cetera. But the only grapes that were available were not the Vitis vinifera that we're so used to having fine wines from, but the Labrusca variety, which were only suitable for sweet, syrupy wines. And that's how...
And
that's how the Kedem and Manischewitz were born.
Oh, no kidding.
In the end, though, they constantly sought after, and in 1978 brought the first Bordeaux in, small, you know, what we call zip code Bordeaux. But over the years, they've been nonstop in trying to improve that, and over the years they have. We've established a winemaker and a winemaking crew within the European theater to address and to speak to all these wineries and let them know that there is a high-end wine drinker within the Jewish community, whether it be in England or France or certainly America, and they've listened. And now you have the Rothschilds making kosher cuvées. You have, like I said, Les Combes and Cantenac Brown and Chiscour and Léoville Poffier and Malartique, and I mean, I can go on and on and on.
Now, the interesting thing is, you said the people who came over to the United States to begin with back in the 1840s, but the wines that we're talking about here are being made in the fine vineyards of Europe.
That's correct.
Now, let me clarify.
The family, the Herzog family, did not come over in the 1840s. In the 1840s, they were very much at home in Czechoslovakia making wines for Europe. It's only in the mid 1940s when they needed to escape the horrible Holocaust that they escaped, thanks to their Gentile workers who hid them throughout the war, that they were able to escape to the United States and then reestablish their winery here on the Lower East Side of Manhattan.
But nobody's making kosher wines of this quality here in the U.S. yet, or am I wrong?
California?
Are the Californians doing it?
Yes, back in 1986, they started making wine, what we call, what you would call, what we all call in the industry, custom crush, at other people's wineries. And then in 14 years ago, I believe, they built their own winery in Oxnard, California, and now some of the most highly rated wines from California being made at the Herzog Wine Cellars in Oxnard, California.
You know, before we go any further, I think listeners might be wondering, if they don't know, what exactly, if these wines are exactly the same as mainstream high-end wines that we drink, why? What makes them kosher?
Okay, it's a great question. The difference between kosher food and non-kosher food, or other kosher consumables and non-kosher consumables, is ingredient-based as a general rule. So, for example, cookies, let's just use that as a silly example, cannot contain non-kosher ingredients such as gelatin or shellfish or, you know, pork products or fats that come from non-kosher animals, which sometimes they can or will. Drinks, same thing. But in the case of wine, it has nothing to do with the ingredients. In the case of wine, because of ancient historics where wine was used in sacramental ritual rites amongst pagans, the rabbis decreed that even though the ingredients of wine is completely kosher, because grapes, there's nothing non-kosher about the grapes or grape juice, it's just the usage that was where it was used during the process by pagans that they wanted to prevent it from happening. So they decreed that from the crushing of the grape until the sealing of the bottle, the entire process needed to be overseen and handled by an observant Jewish crew. And that has remained in effect since ancient times. And so really, the difference between kosher and non-kosher wines is simply that, is the process, not the ingredients.
So it's not like what a lot of wines are not vegan because
egg
eggshells are used in the fining of the wine in the process.
Correct.
So that's still true of wines being vegan.
But correct.
But there's the similar thing does not apply as you
correct.
Just explained.
Right. So for example, you know, kosher wines can use egg whites as a fining agent.
Okay.
But what they can't use is gelatin.
Yeah,
because
well,
gelatin is an animal byproduct that often will come from non-kosher animals. And, for example, what they can't use is sodium caseinate, which is a dairy byproduct, which even though kosher would render the wine dairy,
so
and therefore the wine couldn't be used during a meat meal.
Mm-hmm.
So, now to be frank, many non-kosher wineries don't use gelatin and don't use sodium caseinate either.
Mm-hmm.
But again, the key to it is that from the crushing of the grape until the wine is sealed in the bottle, it's overseen and handled by an observant crew so that it won't be defiled in a spiritual sense. It wouldn't have been blessed for you know, Zeus or Apollo or some kind of pagan ritual rite.
Now you've got some other good news for Jewish observant people. I think you mentioned in your press release a sparkling wine that's in a fairly expensive category, so it must be pretty good.
Oh my gosh! The Rothschild family has begun. This is actually the third cuvée, I think, the second or third cuvée that they've released. The Rothschild Champagne, which is the confluence of all the three Rothschild families that own Latour and Lafitte and Chateau Clark, have come together as one. It's the first time in, I don't know, about 90 years that they've come, you know, they're all friendly, but this is the first time they've come together to make wine together, and this is this French Champagne. And they've agreed to make a smaller part of that cuvée of champagnes kosher.
Now,
the wine is absolutely magnificent.
Now, where is it made? Is it? I thought
in Champagne, France.
Oh, it is made in the Champagne region.
Of course.
Okay.
Of course.
Well, I thought it would have to be.
And what's interesting about it is, unlike many other wineries that blend, you know, one of three different wines, Pinot Noir, Pinot Meunier and Chardonnay, they use 100% Chardonnay, and their feeling is even though it's more expensive, it's much more elegant and much more, they even say complex, and much more difficult and more expensive to make, but really makes a really magnificent wine. I have to tell you, you know, one of the things that I do when I go, I was just away for Shabbat for this past Sabbath at my daughter's parents' in-laws' home, and I brought several wines, one from Israel, one from California, one from from France, and I'm sorry, one from Italy, and also one, the champagne. And you can always tell what the favorite of the evening is, or of the meal is, when it's the first one to go is the one that,
yeah, exactly,
that you know is the favorite. And guess what? The Rothschild champagne was the first to go.
Mm-hmm.
And this is even amongst, you know, we had like a half, I would say eight or nine people, and a couple of them only like sweeter wine, you know, like Moscato types.
Oh, yeah.
Yet, this is the wine that they drank first, and it's completely dry. So, you know, I would say we're very excited about, more than anything else, the growth in quality and prestige wines that are now available to the kosher consumer.
Now, we were talking before we came on the air about the Rothschild family in my native land of Britain, because we went to their wonderful baronial estate during the time we were visiting last December. But it occurs to me that if you haven't yet started working on a kosher sparkling wine or Pinot Noir from England, be a good idea to jump on it pretty soon, because all the land's going fast.
Oh, yeah, and people, especially champagne.
You know, I'll tell you that the only, I'm not, frankly, and I know pretty much a lot about wines, but
yeah,
I'm really not that familiar with wines that are actually grown and produced, you know, in the UK.
Right.
Except for some aging of ports.
Right. Well,
I'm not really familiar with wines that are produced there.
Here's what's been happening. There was a tradition of making sweet wines using grape juice imported from somewhere else,
uh-huh,
which was just totally awful stuff.
Right.
But with the onset of global warming in the last 100 years or so, enterprising people have noticed that the temperatures in both the winter and the summer months are very similar to those in the Champagne region of France.
I'd love to explore that.
Why not?
If you can hook me up, that'd be great.
Yeah, sure.
There are a couple of names. I'll look them up and I'll email them to you.
That would be wonderful.
But it's interesting.
Well, there's that woman that we knew in London who her whole shop sold nothing but UK wines. Remember?
You'll have to help me find that one.
I'm enamored by their Dover soles, and I'm enamored by their cheeses, and of course, I'm of course enamored by some of their whiskies.
Yeah,
but
right,
frankly, I have not been aware of or, you know, sensitive to the wonderful, perhaps sparkling wines or other wines that they're able to produce.
Well, it's
there.
Let me give you
a starting point, and then we'll look up a couple of the others. There's one in particular that's very well known in Kent called Chapeldown.
I'm ready to make a kosher cuvée anytime they are.
And as I mentioned,
that's a thought, that's really great, Jay.
This is somewhere that's only 100 miles away from the Rothschild estate.
There's
every reason to suppose that, in fact, you could grow champagne grapes there as well.
What's nicest about exploring that possibility? It gives me an excuse to visit the country. Nothing else.
Yeah, I had another question here.
Sure.
It gets complex. There are all these traditional foods for Passover, but it's changing. I mean, the foods are changing, and how many inquiries? I mean, because you've got a much more global input instead of just Ascadosi, that's my chocolate maker. I'm sorry. The menus are getting more global, if you know what I mean.
Absolutely.
So if somebody comes to you for help, how do they do that? I mean, do you have on your website, do you answer questions, do you talk to somebody about planning a match between the kosher wines for Passover and the changing kosher menus?
Well, I'll do two things for you.
Okay.
One thing that I never do, but I'll do anyway here. Anyone in your listenership is certainly welcome to contact me directly at my personal email, at the letter J, Buchsbaum, B-U-C-H-S-B-A-U-M, at Kedem.com. But there is a wonderful, wonderful website called kosher.com, simply K-O-S-H-E-R.com, which has an amazing array of recipes and dishes for the holidays. I will say that the reason, you're absolutely right on target, Ann, and I will say that one of the reasons for that is that because of social media and the ability to communicate across boundaries, whether they be geographical or emotional or social, is that, you know, you have Chinese Jews, you have Australian and Iranian Jews. Yes, that's true. It's small, but you still have them.
I already know an Iraqi Jew.
Iraqi Jews, Israeli Jews, South American Jews, Chilean Jews, Argentinian Jews, all of which have their own, you know, lovely local fare that they incorporate into their local seders.
Yes.
And as long as it's kosher and meets the qualification of non-leavened, et cetera, there's no reason why they can't be included in the Seder meal. You know, it used to be Americans led the way with, you know, corned beef or chicken or gefilte fish or whatever. And now there's such a diversity of humanity that there's such an eclectic group of the possibility of kosher foods that can be included in the Seder that that's exactly what's happening. And there's one thing I want to get back to, though. We keep talking about how the kosher consumer wants these high-end Grand Crus. What we insist on pushing forward is that we would like people to taste and enjoy our kosher wines, our kosher cuvées, not because they're kosher, but simply because they're good.
Which is that's the biggest change that's come about, and that's probably why you've got more consumers. Because
exactly.
It used to be that the wines were so awful. You know?
I mean, I'll just give you one example of that. The single biggest SKU, and that's Wine Speak,
yeah,
for the single
right.
biggest single item in our portfolio, is a Moscato d'Asti from Italy.
Mm-hmm.
90%. We guesstimate 90% of that consumer is not Jewish or kosher.
Right, right.
They just are drinking. It happens to be a kosher cuvée, had to be a kosher wine, but they're drinking it because they love it, because it's just good wine.
Right, right.
And
now,
we would like to, it's our Baron Herzog Jeunesse or our, I mean, it's a little bit more difficult with some of the Grand Crus because they're much more expensive initially anyway.
Yeah.
Not ten years down the road, you won't know the difference because they're going to be so much more expensive. But they're just made great. They're just made great, we would hope. And if they're not made great, don't drink them because we didn't do a good job.
Mm-hmm.
But don't drink them only because they're kosher. Choose them. And I'm talking to a non-kosher consumer. The kosher consumer pretty much has no choice. But the non-kosher consumer, explore the kosher range of wines because they happen to just be great wines, especially when it comes to the Baron Herzog and Jeunesse group of wines that we're making out of California.
Now, what do we say? What's the right thing to say? In English, I can say, Happy Seder. What would you say in Hebrew?
In Hebrew, you say a kosher Seder, have a happy and kosher Seder, meaning, you know, do it right. That's all it means, really.
Well, thank you so much for bringing us up to date. It's been fun, as always, to talk to you, and you're always bringing us exciting new information. We must get back together again before too many more years have passed.
Yeah, and you always prove that wine, indeed, could be a mitzvah.
I have to tell you, we have... It seems like there was a hitch, but we have a whole series, a whole slew of samples coming your way. They should have been there already, but you know, if and when you'd like you get them and like to taste them, and you know, do a quick, simple review of what you've tasted. And I'm happy to say, you know, to hear from you. Well, you know what? We tasted 9 of them, and well, these 2 were okay, but. Not to the standards we'd like. That's fine, too. So, you know, if that happens and you're in the mood, I'm here for you.
Okay, Jay. Well, we love talking to you. Thanks.
Well, watch this space, listeners, and we'll get back to Jay about that.
I want to especially thank you and your lovely wife, but more importantly, especially your listenership for hearing us out here today.
Thanks, Jay.
Bye bye. Okay, sweetheart. That's a wrap, as they say.
Yeah.
Till same time, same place next week. We hope we'll see you then. And until then,
bye bye.